Welcome to the Look Far podcast, Voices from the Wild. Join Look Far Conservation as we talk to conservation leaders from around the world about their work, their life, the challenges they face, and the successes they've had.
When it comes to private business, whether it's a private company or a public company, in many ways, that's where the impact happens, right? When you provide a service, when you provide a good, when you are part of any system, you know, economic system in any country, you are closely aligned with environmental impact. The vast majority, of course, of that impact is negative impact. And if you are having an impact on others or an impact on the environment, I think, and Patagonia thinks, that that impact comes with a responsibility.
Welcome back to the Look Far podcast. I'm Scott Stone, the host. A really interesting conversation this week with Avi Garbo, a lawyer by training who's had a distinguished career with the Obama and Biden administrations, and in the private sector with Patagonia, among other stops. What really stood out in talking to Avi is how committed he is to protecting the environment and how determined he is to surmount the many challenges facing anyone trying to do so. And in that, I was really struck by the differences he highlighted between government and the private sector, where in government you have this tremendous profile, this great perch, but you have to work under the relatively limited authority provided under the law by Congress and adhere to all manner of regulatory processes and procedures. The private sector, by contrast, isn't subject to those limits, though few companies are as forceful in their environmental advocacy as Patagonia. In fact, many are pointed in the opposite direction. In any event, as someone who worked for many years practicing environmental law in Washington, D.C., like myself, I really loved the chance to delve into all these legal and policy issues in the broader conservation context that the podcast tries to provide. It's a bit of a departure from our usual frontline fare, but I think well worth it. As always, if you'd like to learn more about Look Far Conservation's work, do check out our website, lookfar.org. But in the meantime, buckle up and enjoy. Here's Avi. Welcome back to the Look Far podcast. I am really excited that Avi Garbo is joining us today, environmental advocate at Patagonia. Before that, served in the Obama administration as general counsel to the Environmental Protection Agency. Avi, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Scott. It's great to be with you.
So I wanted to just dive right in and ask you, Obama EPA general counsel, advocate, lawyer for Patagonia, are those jobs really all that different? Or do you find that you kind of have the same mission, the same focus? How would you compare and describe those two pursuits?
So I'm going to add a third, Scott, into the mix, because I'm just now about a week off a stint. I took leave at the request of the White House to join the Biden administration for about 6 months to go back to the Environmental Protection Agency, serve as senior counselor to the administrator, and really get that ship turned in the opposite direction from the prior 4 years. And so I'm happy to have spent a couple months doing just that, I hope, and have returned to my perch as environmental advocate at Patagonia. But I guess in short answer to your question, both tremendous opportunities to do what I love to do, which is to advocate for the protection of our planet. But I think some very important distinctions. The most obvious one is, while I think in many ways they are kind of quintessential public service opportunities, notwithstanding Patagonia being a private company, the political concerns and guardrails within any administration, whether it's the Biden administration or the Obama administration, are real. And as you know, agencies like EPA are only allowed to act within their authorities. And so while we try to follow the best science, they're not always the best answers. And an easy example, and I'm sure we'll touch on this, is climate change, right? We don't have a climate change law in the United States. And so agencies like EPA and administrations like the Obama administration and now the Biden administration are really looking at every tool at their disposal to use with existing authorities. But there are some limitations there. And I think being the environmental advocate at Patagonia, I really get to have a slightly broader perch and push not only for governmental action, but for, importantly, private sector action on these issues that we care about.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm wondering, how would you describe the role of environmental advocate for a company like Patagonia? What's your day at the office like?
So I would want to describe it as a real privilege, again, to work at a company that in the first instance would hire somebody in the role as environmental advocate. I will say as an aside that nothing would give me greater pleasure than if that title and more importantly, that function were to proliferate in the private sector, but we'll start small and we'll hopefully aim big there. But one of the things just to acknowledge is that a company like Patagonia has embedded into its history a mission to save our home planet. That's kind of why we go to work every day. Certainly, we've got the work that we do in producing the excellent product, but we talk about ourselves as both an experiment and a responsible company. And that experiment and being responsible is inextricably linked to how we conduct ourselves vis-a-vis the planet, what our footprint looks like, how we can model, in effect, leadership behaviors for other companies, not necessarily in our sector, but how you can, again, exist as a profitable enterprise, a profitable company, and still do those things that are very important, if not necessary, to address environmental crises like climate change, to address all of the communities of interest, not just the environment, but your employees and kind of other important stakeholders. So I go in every day, Patagonia, trying to think, you know, what can we do with our voice, with our resources, with our communities to try to move the ball as forward as possible and as widely as possible when it comes to environmental protection. And it's not just, EPA-centric issues, you know, kind of pollution and emissions. It's conservation issues. It's importantly agricultural issues. Regenerative organic ag is a very important priority for us, and we think has to be connected to environmental improvement. Public lands, of course, extraordinarily important to Patagonia, and I like to think to all Americans. And so those are the things that we think about. And I guess the last footnote I'd put on this, Scott, is that while an entity like EPA is, of course, U.S. focused, notwithstanding the global dimensions of climate change and other environmental issues, Patagonia is an international company. And our mission is global. And so constantly trying to see not only where we can make an impact here in the United States, but also internationally on pressing environmental problems.
Yeah. And so there's a million directions I want to go in and stuff I want to ask you about. I'm going to try and control myself and go one at a time and not ask you 10 questions all in a row and then turn you loose. So let me see if I can do this. Let's start with Patagonia. So you arrived there after your stint in the Obama administration. We all know who was in the White House at that time. And I wonder if we could focus on the Bears Ears National Monument, designated by President Obama in December 2016, so after the election, and was then, you know, significantly reduced in size by the following administration in a very controversial manner and I believe unprecedented in terms of the way in which the Antiquities Act was used. I actually learned probably more about what was going on there from Patagonia and its advocacy and messaging on this than I did maybe from, say, the New York Times or whatever. I'm wondering if you could share sort of how you sort of looked at that. I'm not sure if this was while you had gotten there yet or before you'd started at Patagonia, but what that sort of looked like to you and kind of your thoughts on how a private company could take such an aggressive policy posture that had nothing to do with core operations, but really was more of a values play for the company and you know your perspectives and sort of insights on that.
Yeah. So let me just start at the last thing you said, which is our mission is separate in so many ways from what you describe as our core operations, or maybe I should say it the opposite. Our core operations feed into our mission every day, you know, left to right, top to bottom. And so when you think about the bear's ears issue and why did a company like Patagonia wade in, I think you have to stray no further than our mission, which is, again, to be in business to save the home planet. And things like bear's ears and preserving the ecological significance, the cultural significance, the significance to the Native American communities, that is really a central feature of what we're about, and I think what we have been doing for a couple decades. So the idea that we would fight for this issue and fight to preserve those boundaries really shouldn't have come as a surprise to anybody that follows Patagonia. But in terms of kind of how we came about that, I'll say as well, I was not there yet. I was, after the Obama administration, I was in a private law practice for a period of time before I came to Patagonia. And it was in those intervening months or 2 years or so that Patagonia took the bold, if not necessary, step to file litigation to, you know, ensure that the Antiquities Act was followed. And we did that, I think, for a couple of reasons. First, we did it because we had long worked with and supportive Native American groups and other grassroots activists that had made that area an issue of concern for them, that they had tracked that very special place for so many years. It was also a place, I think, very close to other communities that work with Patagonia. So we knew it was special. The other thing is, this was such a brazenly unlawful act by the Trump administration. You talk about something that's not been done before. It really goes in many ways to just the basic rule of law and what the Antiquities Act allows and what it doesn't allow. And I think this was an assessment by Patagonia, by others who also filed suit there, that this was a patently unlawful, if not unjustified, action undertaken by the Trump administration. And the best way to correct it was to go immediately to the courts. And so I think that's what Patagonia did. My understanding is between our general counsel and the board of directors, there was really a unanimous assessment that this is where Patagonia ought to be. And you talked earlier, Scott, about learning a little bit more from Patagonia than from other sources about this issue. That's one of the things that makes Patagonia so special and also quite important in the world of environmental protection and conservation is our ability to connect and to storytell. And we have an ability, again, to bring to life in certain visual and audio and other kind of connective ways, environmental issues where people can begin to care and express their voice in ways that reading an article online or in a newspaper just doesn't doesn't enrage you or doesn't enliven that debate enough. So our ability to really push all of our buttons, use all of our tools, and then go to court is really what makes our activity in the Bears Ears lawsuit so important.
Yeah, and coming at it from the perspective too of a business, a values-driven business, but still a dot-com. To me is really interesting and brings to mind something I was talking about with Lookfar works with Fairtrade and was talking with its founder and CEO, Paul Rice, a couple of weeks ago. And Paul created the US incarnation of Fairtrade in the mid to late 1990s. And he described it as, you know, back then, if you were interested in doing social good, you created a nonprofit organization. And yet when you look at Fairtrade's work in certifying all manner of products and returning that premium that consumers pay for those products to the, you know, million farms around the world that are Fairtrade certified and factories and whatnot, that it's, there's very much a strong kind of commercial element. And yeah, I'm wondering what you think about this, but in thinking about, there's always obviously going to be a major role for nonprofit groups. I mean, Lookfar is one. And so I say this with both self-interest and just with knowledge that that's going to be an important feature no matter what. But the special ability of a business, of private enterprise, to weigh in as well and to avail themselves of the same legal mechanisms that regulated industries use when they don't like, say, a rule coming down the chute from EPA, but instead of seeking exceptions or less stringency or whatever, actually, you know, defending parts of our environment, that's a role that that businesses could play. You mentioned Patagonia setting an example. I think it sets a wonderful example. How would you gauge sort of the prospects of others in this era where, you know, the letters ESG seem to be everywhere you look? How powerful do you think that example is right now and will be going forward in terms of bringing other businesses into this sort of more activist posture?
One, I think there's immense potential. And I would actually characterize it less as asking yourself, what are you able to do? And more, what are you responsible for? And when it comes to private business, whether it's a private company or a public company, in many ways, that's where the impact happens, right? When you provide a service, when you provide a good, when you are part of any system, you know, economic system in any country, you are closely aligned with environmental impact. The vast majority, of course, of that impact is negative impact. And if you are having an impact on others or an impact on the environment, I think, and Patagonia thinks, that that impact comes with a responsibility, right? A responsibility to try to improve your own operations and a responsibility to care for those around you, to those, in fact, who are distant from you, a responsibility to preserve lands and take care of wildlife and look for opportunities for environmental and planetary improvement. And so that's where I think we have the greatest opportunity going forward. Again, hearkening back to an earlier kind of juxtaposition between, well, what was life like in the government versus what are the opportunities or life in the private sector? The private sector is, in my mind, where the greatest upside is. There are financial constraints. There are political constraints to what the government can do. There are, of course, fundamentally legal constraints there in what the laws might allow. But companies have a far greater latitude, I think, to make decisions and make changes and bear, in fact, a greater responsibility because of their connection to environmental impact. So whether it's environment and social governance or corporate social responsibility or whatever three-letter acronym is going to follow on to that, it's getting companies to understand their responsibility to act. And then again, to push and to prod and to lead and to help those companies that don't have the wherewithal or the expertise. And that, I think, is one of the areas that Patagonia can play a great role, is we've got the expertise, we've got the track record, we've got the mission that pushes us again into leadership positions. And with that is, I think, the obligation to bring others forward and again, help shine a light on the path forward, not just for Patagonia, the outdoor apparel company, or Provisions, the regenerative organic food company, but for all companies who can see the alignment between economic opportunity and environmental progress.
I want to come back to regenerative ag and what's going on in Provisions, because I think that's such an important area and one that on the conservation side, we seem to encounter more and more, I know, in Lookfar's work. But first, let's pivot to EPA, because, you know, you referred to there are limitations when you're in government. And as I think some folks know, you know, I'm a lawyer myself. I lived and worked in Washington, D.C. for about 15 years for the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development and in private practice, and remain involved on issues, climate policy issues that relate to refrigeration and air conditioning issues, among others. But I'm very familiar with your work at EPA. Didn't know each other then, but I certainly knew who you were and was paying close attention. And the thing I always come back to is, if more people understood the basic tenets of administrative law, our political discourse would be radically different. Because when in government, there's some extraordinary things you can do, but there's also a lot that is really bound by what kinds of authority Congress has granted, and then the processes that you have to follow in terms of wielding that authority. To contrast the two, how would you sort of describe in your time at EPA, you know, how you grappled with those limitations in terms of legal authority and in terms of process to try and pursue what were very ambitious policy objectives?
So let me start out, Scott, by maybe further illustrating for our audience I think for me, what best shows the limitations that we're operating under in government, and you know this very well, environmental law in the United States, which I would say, by the way, is among the most protective environmental legal regimes around the world. We are, in spite of our many failures and limitations, still in many ways decades ahead of many others, and we can be a model for progress for other countries. But our environmental laws tended to be born from environmental disasters. So you think about the Santa Barbara oil spill in the Cuyahoga River in Ohio catching on fire, right? That spurred Clean Water Act action. You think about the smog in LA and other things that kind of spurred Clean Air Act action. And on, Love Canal kind of gave us Superfund, et cetera. And those statutes were designed to address particular problems in specific medias. So all of a sudden, we created these verticals or silos. This is how we're going to deal with air emissions. This is how we're going to deal with water emissions. This is how we're going to deal with land protections, et cetera. And NGOs built up around that. The Environmental Protection Agency built around that. And we have an air office and a water office. And you've developed this wonderful expertise that is in many ways limited and is missing the horizontal part of pollution, right? And I used to use this example when I was back at EPA in the Obama administration. We would write a regulation to take toxic emissions out of an air stack. And we'd see the results. It would be tremendously effective. We'd applaud ourselves and you know, we have reduced air pollution. Well, the facilities who had to make those reductions, those pollutants just didn't disappear. They just moved elsewhere. And so they would move them into the water. And so then we said, okay, well, we've got to do a water regulation, and we'd regulate the toxic, you know, effluent for water, and we'd applaud. We've got all these reductions. And next thing we know, it's going into landfills and so on and so on. And we need to get to a place where we're not moving the problem around and addressing it with different statutes. We need to figure out how holistically and horizontally to address these issues. And one of the places where this is in greatest focus and it kind of has the most dire need for attention is environmental justice. Because if you think about aggrieved communities where there are overburdened pollutions, they don't care what the specific pathway is other than it's impacting their ability to breathe. It's impacting those ability, you know, those children in that community to learn and for folks to make a good living. So figuring out ways of tapping into the best strategies in a multimedia sense is both the greatest limitation and difficulty in the way we're structured in government, but also the greatest opportunities for us to think creatively. And that's, for example, one way where I think business has the advantage, because they can go beyond the confines and the narrowness and the verticality of the statutes, and they can think operationally, what are we doing and where can we make changes to not only move pollution, but to reduce and eliminate it.
Yeah, you know, that's well said. And that example too, with pulling hazardous air pollutants out of the stack and the kinds of chemical mixtures you can use to do that, and then where they go, is an example I've often used, you know, myself, to sort of show that these cross-media issues are not effectively covered by what are essentially siloed approaches, you know, in statute and in agency organization to addressing them. And I'm wondering, you know, how much do you need new law, which obviously is a tall order, because that would involve an act of Congress, and not only an act of Congress, but an act of Congress that incorporates a fair bit of common sense and vision, which can be with all due respect to folks on the Hill, that can be a challenge. Or is it different practice or strategy by federal regulatory agencies? Or could it be maybe, you know, a different posture in the private sector in terms of thinking about compliance more holistically to try and address these above and beyond what might be specifically mandated by some regulation? Or is it some combination? I mean, how best to grapple with this phenomenon?
Yeah, so it is clearly a D, all of the above answer, Scott, to what you've said. New laws would be great, but let's be honest, right? Got to be the right law. And the peril right now with our current congressional makeup is, you know, what do you do when you introduce a particular amendment? And then we've all seen the kind of political gridlock that can ensue. But there are opportunities for new laws out there. There are new laws being considered now, Growing Climate Solutions Act, which is an ag and climate act. Some of the senators have put forward acts to address environmental justice and to require cumulative impact assessments and health impacts on overburdened minority and low-income communities. So yes, new laws would be great, but they take some time and we can't count on them. New strategies in government are really also important, as you point out. And for example, I think one of the things that the Biden administration is doing very well so far and that I've got very high hopes for it doing is one on the climate area. It's really taking an all of government approach that's unlike anything that we've seen before. The fact that the Secretary of the Treasury, the Secretary of Agriculture, and on has within their front offices climate advisors, which used to be really within the kind of primary purview of an agency like EPA, says a lot. The fact that Gina McCarthy and her office are in the White House, kind of pulling all of the levers, I think sends a tremendous amount. And so calibrating our expectations and raising those expectations from each part of government and using it creatively is absolutely necessary, I think, to kind of break out of what has constrained us in the past. Private businesses, as I said, need to stop looking at laws as simply a floor. I mean, the idea of complying with the law is in many ways, one, necessary, but that makes you a bottom dweller in a sense, right? You have done just what is required by the law and no more. We need to actually ramp up our business expectations and aspirations to meet the crisis and the challenge, not simply to hover around the minimally required compliance obligations set forth in the law. And so it kind of accelerating technology, having companies do things again that they're not merely required to do, but that they are responsible and capable of doing. This is the stew, if you will, I think, that requires attention in the years and decades to come if we're really going to turn the corner on some of these pressing problems.
Yeah. And the way I think about it, well, first of all, it's weird to think that 1990 was 31 years ago. I don't know if I'll ever be able to accept that. But if you go back to 1990, obviously a major sort of legislative watershed moment with the passage of the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, where you saw significant leadership from a Republican administration in George H.W. Bush in their design. And then, you know, their implementation largely through a Democratic administration under Clinton. But then since, you know, you've gone from Bush Sr. to Clinton to George W. Bush, then to Obama, then to Trump, now to Biden. And you've seen federal agencies over that time, when a new one comes in, tends to try and correct and pull things in the opposite direction of where prior administration took it. And courts often get involved. And while there are few vacatures, there's plenty of sort of touch-ups on remand. And I feel like, you know, in the end, if you are a regulated entity and you have to think about a multi-decadal compliance plan, the idea that you're just playing for a friendly administration to come in to ease up a little bit seems pretty short-sighted, because history shows that doesn't last very long. And while I'm sure there are all number of specific exceptions where those few years can make a difference, good businesses tend to think a bit more longer term than that, and certainly invest in capital stock that can last 10, 20, 30 years and longer. So bottom line is, to your point, thinking about environmental standards, not as, you know, what might be inscribed in a final rule, but something that, looking ahead, you can think, well, where do we really want to be in this discussion? What best serves our long-term interests? What best rewards shareholders? It's rarely being a bottom dweller, right? I mean, it seems like while you don't necessarily need to lead the pack, it pays to be progressive on that. And do you think the past 30 years are enough of a case study for that to be persuasive across most industrial sectors, particularly publicly held companies? Or do you feel like the pendulum will just kind of continue to swing and the bulk will struggle to see more than, you know, just a few years ahead in terms of what a compliance strategy could be?
I think, Scott, that the political pendulum, sadly, is always susceptible to a swing. And while I may have my own kind of very progressive political ideas, they don't always marry up with election results. And so I think you can easily forecast changes in administration, even within the parties, that portend small, medium, or large changes when it comes to regulation. Now, I will say, looking back on the 8 years of the Obama administration, that because we followed the science, because we followed the rules of law, even though the vast majority of our major actions were challenged in courts, we had something like a 70 to 90% rate, if you will, of affirmance in the courts. That is to say, ultimately, what we did and the regulations that we set were affirmed by the courts. The Trump administration, steering clear of science, not following the rule of law, had a vastly lower rate of being upheld in the courts. And so I think at the end of the day, actions that follow the science and follow the law will ultimately be more durable. And if you are a company, that's the signals you need to follow, and there's where you need to make your investments. But I think kind of stepping again beyond the political realm, which is where we find the most susceptibility to swings, I am seeing a shift, I guess, in the private sector in how they're viewing things. For one, your reference to what will reward the shareholders is no longer just the only North Star for businesses. First, you had the Business Roundtable, which represents a lot of large companies, come out and I'd say softly redefine the purpose of a corporation. But then you've got organizations like B Lab and B Corporations. Patagonia, for example, is a benefit corporation. And we understand, and B Corporations more generally understand, that the sole responsibility for a company is not simply to reward your direct investors or your shareholders, but to have a broader sense of community and stakeholders, to include the environment, your employees, your local communities, et cetera. And when you do that, you start thinking, I think, in a longer pathway, right? You're not simply looking at your quarterly reports and what's the market going to do in response to this. You're trying to figure out, where are we going to be? Where do we need to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 50 years from now? And where do we need to position ourselves to meet these environmental challenges that we see in front of us, but we know are apt to get greater over time? So I'm somewhat heartened, if you will, by the notion that I think more and more companies are starting to understand and see their role in society in different ways than they did in the past.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. And I think, although it's alarming to look at so much evidence of changes to the climate and the havoc they're wreaking all over the world, that really does make it difficult for any company that would plan to be in business 5 years from now, 10 years from now, to pursue a strategy that doesn't take that into account and to think about, you know, we best manage the risks we face by pursuing progressive paths on our own emissions and other impacts we might have on the environment and so forth, that it's hard to defend an alternate course if you're thinking even moderately long-term. Before we leave the public sector, you're right that I forgot to mention at the outset that you've also just been in the Biden administration. I'm wondering, thinking about your time in the Obama administration, then you had this great opportunity to come in early in the Biden administration and advise EPA and Administrator Regan. Do you have specific lessons or points that you draw from your time during the Obama era to Biden? I mean, I'm curious what, I know you probably can't tell us all the awesome advice that you gave the administrator, but to the extent you can share, what were your key lessons or your key points that you might have taken away from those years?
So I feel it's a little awkward to kind of try to distill, you know, what you might daily counsel somebody into a couple key points. And certainly what I was able to add to the incoming administration was a degree of experience both at the agency and in political leadership in the Obama years. But the folks that the Biden administration has put in at the political level, certainly at EPA, are extraordinarily talented, experienced in their own right. And I have great kind of confidence in their abilities to help lead that agency. Now, keep in mind, they are leading an agency that has 98-99% career. And the career ranks there are exemplary public servants. So with or without anybody steering the ship, I tend to think that the agency is in already pretty good shape if we would just listen to the career scientists and experts at that agency. And so, you know, part of what I think is a sea change in the Biden administration versus the Trump administration is a respect for the career staff and what they bring to the table, but also an understanding that if you are to succeed, you need to consider the best information. And oftentimes, it is those career scientists, those career lawyers, those career economists and policy specialists that bring that to the table. But just going a little bit back to a comment that I made earlier on about the siloed approach at the agency. One of the things that I certainly had conversations with folks at EPA about was how to look at things horizontally. And so in an issue like environmental justice, we need to think a little bit more broadly than just what's the program office going to do. What does the air office say about this or the water office say about this? And we need to start with our external stakeholders, that is to say, the beleaguered communities, and ask what they need. And therefore, if we know what they need, then we start picking our delivery points, right? And it's not going to be just one area or another. Another great example is on PFAS chemicals. You know, people talk about these as forever chemicals. And there is, I think, an instinctive reaction in government or certainly at the EPA to, again, look kind of case by case. You know, what can we do in this particular program office? But if you start looking at the problem kind of holistically and then start figuring out what are the various levers that we can press, whether it's in beginning a drinking water regulation process, whether it's in looking to identify certain PFAS chemicals as hazardous substances to allow different enforcement resources to be brought. These sorts of cross-agency programs, really driving them through and making everybody collectively accountable so that one office can't say, not my area, or you know, the lead is elsewhere. Everybody needs to be responsible and to weigh in. And I think that's something that this EPA leadership understands and will expect from its staff.
I would just like, since everyone won't be able to see how vigorously my head was nodding when you were endorsing the judgment and wisdom of career EPA staff, I just want to make clear, I completely agree. And always a wise and smart move to listen to the career staff, because they really do know an extraordinary amount and have devoted their professional lives to environmental protection. So it's an incredible resource we have in the public sector. We have to wind down soon, but before we go, I wanted to maybe see if we could dig in a little bit into regenerative agriculture and the role that that is playing in, well, certainly Patagonia Provisions, and then just more broadly, kind of in this sustainability, conservation, environmental discussion. From Lukvar's standpoint, I feel like every time we turn around in looking at a conservation project in Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa, although the nominal focus might be on forests or wetlands or whatnot, there's often farmland or some kind of community effort nearby, and a real interest in agroforestry or some form of regenerative approach. And it's exciting because there seems to be extraordinary potential to use regeneration in concert with conservation and restoration to produce sort of optimal outcomes for the environment, for people, for animals, and everything. I'm really bullish about it. I'm curious what your view is from Patagonia Perch and what more there might be worth looking at or doing in trying to carry this forward.
So one, I think, agriculture kind of writ large is both a solution to many problems, certainly food and nutritional issues, but it's also an incredible problem, both on the nutritional side, but more importantly, on the land conservation side, on the pollution side. A tremendous amount of our water pollution is attributable to the way in which this country and others do industrial chemical agriculture. It is certainly a polluter of our air. And if you look simply at the amount of acreage in this country that's devoted to agriculture or grazing and ranching, a significant amount. So one, I start, like most things, is here we have an overlay between problem and solution. The opportunity, in a sense, is one and the same. And I think we know that if we're going to provide solutions, we need to move away from the soil depleting, environmentally polluting, large-scale industrial agriculture that we've got. And so I think you must inexorably move in the direction of organic, and then even beyond organic, to think about these regenerative practices that are meant to build up and improve our topsoils, which are drastically diminishing kind of crop year by crop year. And so I think there are a variety of approaches to regenerative and regenerative organic agriculture that you're seeing, one, some larger companies adopt, you know, whether it's addressing how you do tillage or overcropping, overplanting a variety of crops instead of monoculture, and factoring in ways that we can scale this. Now, I will put in a plug for a tremendous new organization, the Regenerative Organic Alliance, which is looking to standardize in some ways some regenerative and organic practices, where organic is the baseline, but they layer onto that, I think, some standards and expectations that look not only to soil health, but to animal welfare, hugely, I think, important in the scheme of things, but also to the people side of things. Again, keep in mind, the folks that work these lands are farm workers, and their families are on a daily basis exposed to the very harms that we see in chemical agriculture through insecticides and pesticides, and figuring out ways of lifting them up and improving their lives too, I think, is an important part in how we look to solve the agricultural problem.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's, from a supply chain standpoint, as more and more a company's footprint is being framed, not just in terms of its own immediate operations, but where it's sourcing all of its materials, that the more regenerative practices could be inset, as it were, into a company's supply chain, the better the overall risk profile, the better the environmental performance, and the more the benefits then can flow back to producers upstream in the value chain, and have it not just be a extract and pull and cut and run kind of approach.
Yeah, and Scott, if you, again, not to put, though I will, a brazen plug in for Patagonia Provisions, but, you know, as an example, if you go to the Patagonia Provisions website, if you did this a couple years back, you may have seen just a few items, not very many producers. And I think more and more, you're seeing an increase in number of the items that Provisions is able to sell. But almost as importantly, you're also seeing an increase in the number of producers that are working on regenerative organic practices. And again, creating a marketplace where consumers can go and shop for different things, where they know that, again, the land is being repaired, and not just repaired, but replenished, I think, in a very positive way.
Absolutely. And you're free to plug Patagonia and its affiliates as much as you like. I'm actually wearing a Patagonia jacket as we talk. I've had it for about 15 years. It's still held up just fine.
Well, send it in for repair if you ever have any problems.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. Although one of my friends pulled that Jerry Seinfeld line on me, which he says, you know, all men dress in the style of the last good year of their lives. Because I tend to wear this jacket a lot, but I'm still having good years. It's just, you know, anyway. Well, this has been great, Avi. You know, there's a million and one directions I still would love to go, but I'm mindful of the time and don't want to impose on you any further. We like to wrap up by asking each guest the same three questions as a way to create a sort of standard basis of comparison and to try and rip off Inside the Actor's Studio a little bit without getting into too much trouble. But hopefully this won't be quite so obnoxious. So I'd like to run through those, and then we'll call it a day. The first question is, what gives you hope?
I'd have to say what gives me hope is the increased engagement by people on the issues that I and you and LookFar care about. I mean, the fact that there is vastly more dialogue or discourse on issues of climate change, on issues of regenerative agriculture, on issues, I think, of preserving wild places and the importance of biodiversity, that's hugely important, because until people begin to talk about it, kind of talking about it and seeing it kind of creates connections. Connections create a love of something, and then a love of something kind of creates the urge to protect it. And that's, I think, where we need to head. And I do see, again, a growing interest in these things that really bind us together, environmental protection and kind of needs of our planet.
The second question is, if you could look ahead 10 years, what's one thing that you would hope to see in the world, in your immediate context, that you would hope to see come about, come to pass in the next 10 years?
So I'm going to dodge what might be the obvious, you know, kind of, I want our climate crisis under control and everybody driving electric vehicles. For me, I think what would be great to see, two things. One, we haven't talked much about this, but this idea of 30 by 30, right? The notion of protecting 30% of the world's lands and waters by 2030, hopefully progressing to far more protection. But that stems a little bit from biodiversity concerns and other things. But there are so many benefits that can apply to those sorts of protections. But what I'd really like to see are those protections going hand in hand with greater access to those wild places or those open spaces. Because again, going back to what I said, I think you protect what you love, but you have to know it first. And so if we can begin to, through whatever mechanisms in the next decade, really set aside these lands for these special places, these open spaces, and then provide opportunities for access for the kids in urban areas, for others to really get a sense of why this planet is and can be so special. That's, I think, going to be the greatest catalyst to progress we could rightfully expect. So for me, 10 years down the road, I'd love to solve all the other problems, but I'd sure like to see a lot of opportunities for the next generation to really find their place in a wilder and more open planet.
That's great. You know, and that really calls to mind an earlier podcast episode. We had Grace Lee, the executive director of the National Park Trust, join us. And I'm full disclosure and my own turn for a shameless plug. I serve on the board of trustees of the National Park Trust. A big part of their mission is not just protecting and preserving public lands, particularly national parks, but connecting kids, particularly underprivileged kids, to parks that they might otherwise not have a chance to visit. And that's what inculcates this sense of stewardship and these values that you want in future generations to ensure that these lands and these open spaces continue. So that's spot on. I like that. Last question is, how can people help?
It may sound trite and overused, but get involved. It's easy if you're a politician. It's easy if you're a company executive to either do nothing or to do little when there's no pressures to do more. And so I think figuring out ways in which you can get involved, it doesn't need to be at the national level or beyond that. Go back to the old bumper sticker of Think Global, Act Local. Just figure out where you're passionate, where the issues are in your community, and do something. Stand up, make your voice heard. We all, for the most part, you know, have the same ability to project, and we need to use those attributes as best we can. So become civically active, because it all matters and it matters to you.
Amen. No, I agree. Well, this is great, Avi. And you know, something you said a moment ago about 30 for 30, there's extraordinary ambition when you look at the sheer amount of land that would need to come under some form of protection to achieve that and what that could mean. It implicates rewilding, another fertile area that is something I know we're very interested in. I know you too and others in the Patagonia sphere. And instead, you know, I wanted to geek out about administrative law. So I'm sure we disappointed some people, but hopefully there'll be a chance to come back and maybe continue this conversation down the line and dig into these other topics, because this was great. It was really, I think, inspiring to get your take, given where you've been, given where you are now, and you know, look forward to continuing to look to Patagonia and others, hopefully following its example for inspiration and ideas and you know, good places to go for a good day outdoors.
Good. And Scott, listen, I first of all, you and I can geek out on administrative law anytime. So we can do that offline and spare the audience. But I really do appreciate the chance to talk with you and engage on these issues. I appreciate the work that you and LookFar are doing in this respect. I think it's critically important for virtually everything I touched on. You know, the work that you do kind of continues and gets to be highlighted. So thanks again for the opportunity.
Thanks, Avi. Really appreciate it.
Take care.
LookFar is a U.S. 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to defending wild and wondrous places and working with the people living in and among them. More at lookfar.org.